We have a question about power very often, about what power is, about what to do with it. Tonight we've got a question about its opposite, about the lack of power, which there's a word impotence used. The question is, how do we consider impotence on the three levels of being? And we're going to consider how we deal with impotence on four levels of being. Remember, our three-part man is tied together on the spinal cord as coordinator, and we will write in will, feeling, and thinking. Three levels of being, coordination for the spine, and we'll proceed to examine what it is that causes impotence on any of these levels. And we'll take the most obvious one first. Down in the belly then is the place where we digest food. The correspondent center in the head, of course, is the mouth. A cake hole, as it's popping through. And we draw a tube from the mouth down to the belly land to show the passage down which the food falls. Food is simply material that we put into this hole in the lower part of the face and allow it to drop down to where it can be dealt with chemically by acids and a variety of forces, to break it down, to release the hidden energy in the matter. It's a process similar to the process of nuclear division, similar to making atom bombs, and it's a little quieter and less destructive. But we see that if we don't put the food in and send it down to be digested, broken down, and the energy release, we will not be able to conduct the other functions of the body. You may remember that we've talked about a little story about all the organs of the body all having a terrible argument about who is the most important. And the head said it was the most important because it could think clearly what to do. And the heart thought it was the most important because it felt what was worth doing. But the belly began to sulk and refused to eat, and thereby gained the victory over the other two, because when it didn't eat, then thinking began to fail and the heart began to become agitated. So the belly won in the argument about who was superior by going on strike. And this is the kind of victory that pleases the Marxists, who would agree that an army marches on its stomach as Napoleon believed. The peculiar thing is that the matter that we put into the stomach for digestion can be returned into power only because it is already a condensation of power. If we remember that we have a gross material body and a subtle body of ideas and a causal body of will or higher emotion, then we can see that the physical level of the belly, looked upon as that part which is centered on the gross material, will correspond with the gross material part of the world, and the material food we put into it will then be the lowest part, the mass inertia. Now you know that in modern physics, the concept of matter has been displaced by the concept of mass energy. There is no matter as conceived in the 19th century. Matter is simply a modality of force. When forces rotate, the rotation, the inworking of the forces involved, whereby we use the word inertia, inworking, this inworking of the forces and the rotation of them establishes a point of reference with inertia. But it is only a force that has come in and started to rotate that constitutes matter. So there is really no matter in the old-fashioned sense of the word as opposed to force. Textbooks you can still find lying about on second-hand bookstalls say that the universe is made of matter and force. Such textbooks might be only as short a time ago as 50 years. But today matter and force are not in opposition because matter is a behaviour of force. So the moment we put a piece of cake into the mouth and let it fall down, this cake can turn into force, into energy, simply because it is force. All that we have to do to turn that portion of cake into willpower is to break the inertia of its rotating motion and turn the rotation into a translation. If we can interfere with the constituent motion that constitutes so-called matter, so that instead of spinning, it flies out, develops a centrifugal force, we have turned matter into force. We've done so only because the primary motion, the translating motion, was caught in and began to rotate. Now, we can see, therefore, that willpower is really the power hidden in food. We'll see how many kinds of food there are later. But at the gross material level, food is simply the stuff that people have conditioned themselves to put in their mouths and drop into their stomachs and work upon with acids and so on to break them down, to release this rotating energy and convert it into the energy of motion of the muscles and so on. The old way of spelling will would have been with a G, U, instead of with a W. You get this in the French spelling of the word William, and you get it in the word guilt. We said before that guilt is simply the psychological state that one is in when one's will has been crucified by some action performed. So if we do a certain thing, and the thing we have done places us in a crucified position so that we cannot get off it, and we must now expose ourselves to punishment for the thing done, we say we are experiencing guilt. That is a crucifixion of the will, and the exposing of it in its crucified position to action from outside, reaction from the environment against which the will had been released. The gullet, of course, means the little gull, the bird that flies through the air and is called seagull, really means a flying appetite. The primary gross material power, G for gross material and O for the power of going. So the goo in the word gullet or go, and the W in the word will have really the same significance. We take gross matter and we return it to primary motion. The U, which is the same as a V, and in the Hebrew an O, UVO, or the OVU, all mean the same thing. They mean power. When the power goes into rotation and establishes itself by compression, it is just in the Red Indian greeting Ugh, and symbolizing the passage of power into gross objectification. Now, because this has occurred, because power has condensed itself as matter, therefore the process from matter to power is possible. The other becomes good. It is obvious then that we can have impotence of the will simply by being deprived of energy, by not eating, by not being exposed to sunlight and so on. Impotence of the will can occur simply through lack of energy. One can be too tired, or one can actually be deficient in materials for breaking down, food. there are various methods of getting these energies. Solar radiation is a very important one. It is through solar radiation and photosynthesis that we get most of the energies in our food. If we like to think about a lettuce as a definite amount of sunshine objectified, it is quite a legitimate image. Impotence of the will at the belly level, therefore, can be simply a matter of lack of food, lack of rest, and if anybody has been really tired or had a long fast beyond a certain limit, we can fast much longer than we think when we haven't trained. If this experience of extreme tiredness is undergone through lack of sleep or lack of food, then one becomes aware that the will has got a relation with the food that we take in, whether gross material food or solar radiations or other radiations that might be available. So we'll say very, very simply, one kind of impotence is simply the impotence or lack of power, the sheer lack of the materials that supply the energy that we need. We could call this a negative kind of impotence based on deficiency, simple lack of the energy. If we now climb from the level of the belly into the level of the chest, where the feeling centers are more obviously situated, as we can see by the changes in breathing and heartbeat under emotional stimuli, we find that we have two kinds of feeling, plus and minus, a yes and a no. Now, impotence at this level can arise by the simple contradiction of a situation, where the situation may present us with equal emotional stimuli in contrary directions. We can have an emotion that says yes, come here, and simultaneously another emotion saying no, don't come here. If these two emotions, yes and no, are presented together, then the result is a stasis at the emotional level. There is impotence in the emotion. We find this very, very often when somebody has not had an emotional call made upon them. A recent example of this was a young girl whose relation with her father was in no sense emotional, so that she had not grown up emotionally at all. She had a quite rational relation with him, but no emotion. The result was that all the emotional potential in her, who would have said yes to, say, sitting on her father's knee, never expressed itself, yet it wanted to come out. So that when she started to move towards him, the memories of the previous types of relations she had with him, a cold, rational relation, inhibited the movement towards him, so that she couldn't go and sit on his knee. She wanted to, and she couldn't. She wanted to, because she could feel this potential of feeling, and at the same time, she didn't want to, because she never had done, and she was afraid of repulse. So she had yes and no simultaneously inside her. So she stood a few feet away from her father and looked at him and looked as if she wanted to do something and not wanted to do it simultaneously. This is simultaneous contrary stimulation towards and away from at the emotional level. And this is a fairly common one, but not in its very pure form without a complicating factor of thinking. We'll go up to the thinking level and then we'll return to consider the relation of the three. At the thinking level, we can have ideas of how things work. Remember, how is a word concerned with the mechanics of action, and why is a word concerned with the motive behind the action. At the thinking level of how, the thinking process is concerned with the mechanical means to success in action. And at this point, it is possible to have impotence too, because one may be deficient in the necessary idea information about how something works. floating some little old lady by the TV set, and one day it doesn't go on. So she rings up for the electronic expert, he comes, takes it away, and charges her for a new tube, say £26, and brings it back, and does what he could have done in the first place. He could have plugged the aerial in the back, because that's all that had happened, had been pulled out and had been cleaned. This is an actual incident, not a fabricated one. She was deficient in knowledge. She didn't know that at the back of the set there was a wire with a little thing on and you push it in a hole. All she knew was that the thing had been installed and had gone, and now it wasn't going. She didn't know that in carelessly swinging her hoover about, she'd unplugged the aerial. So at the thinking level again, there can be impotence through lack of information. That's one kind. Generally, people are aware when they lack this information, and they try to get hold of somebody who has the information and persuade that person to bring it into operation. If they can't get that person, then they begin to feel frustrated. But that kind of frustration is fairly clear, because there you know that you don't know a necessary thing X, and you believe somebody else does know it, and yet you can't find the person. You're frustrated and you know what about. But at another level, the thinking process can refute itself. That is to say, part of your education at the level of idea input can make a certain statement, say in the field of biology, and another part of your education, say in the field of chemistry, can make another statement. And these two statements may be contradictory, but because you have learned them at different times, perhaps with a day or two between, you do not bring these two ideas together and see that they refute each other. And therefore you have two ideas in your mind which contradict you, and it may not be obvious to you until you come into a test condition. Perhaps in a certain stimulus situation, these two contrary ideas spring to mind together, and this immobilizes the thinking process, because now you are saying contrary things about the same situation. You have then an experience of what it means to be impotent in thought, not simply through deficiency, but through self-refutation of the idea system itself, internal inconsistencies of the ideas. Now, on the fourth level, the spinal cord, the coordination line, another kind of impotence is possible. It is the failure of power to bring into relation the thinking and feeling and willing functions of the body. Its general cause is sheer lack of speed of perception. If you can speed up your perceptions so that you are flying very rapidly from what you're thinking about to what you're feeling about what you're thinking, and what you're willing to do about what you're feeling and thinking, and then flying backwards and forwards up and down the spinal cord, so that you present yourself more and more with the relation between thinking and feeling and willing, if you can do this, then you are potent. Because you have all the information in the mind you need, you have the feeling you like it or you don't like it, and you have the willpower either to confirm it or to deny it, simply because you're speeding your process up. But if your process is too slow, then your coordination will suffer, because you might see something with your eye that needs looking at, and be rather slow in adapting your emotion to it. And then you might be slow again in using your will to do something about it. You know that if you drink alcohol, like free plum wine or something, and then you start driving a car, your reactions are generally slower than they would be if you were sober. So that you might see a lamppost coming towards you, and it might look as if it's coming at about 10 miles an hour when it's really coming at 18, because your perceptions slowed down. You see something of this in the high-speed stratosphere planes that fly, say, at 1,000, 1,500 miles an hour, and the time between two planes coming together is so short that the human organism has extreme difficulty in making the necessary adjustments to avoid a crash. So there can be actually a deficiency in coordination by sheer failure to speed the process of perception of these three functions up. Now, if we go back to consider this again, when we come to this basic will in the belly, we say it depends primarily on food, that is, on matter that is taken in especially to break down and supply the energy. Let us assume for a moment that we have no food and no energy input at all, then nothing is going to happen, because all work is an expression of energy. But as soon as we put an unlimited supply of energy into the will, so that the belly is continuously supplying the rest of the organism with forces to utilize, then we raise a problem of whether we're going to direct this energy, which of itself is essentially positive, that is, capable of work, a positive form, producing changes and so on. This purely positive energy, when it comes into a situation where the feelings can say either yes or no, the will prefers normally to say yes, because the will is naturally positive. It is a force that works. And it will not become negative unless something opposes the will. If something opposes the will, when it's moving towards something, then the energy of the will begins to pile up behind the resistance. Let's draw a line to represent the will going along without any impedance at all. Nothing is stopping it. It just keeps on moving through space and thoroughly enjoying itself. This will is sentient power. As power, it is producing the changes, and as sentience, it is aware that it is doing so. So that when the will is travelling along without opposition, it enjoys itself very, very much. And this movement of the will without any impedance whatever is what we mean by bliss, and which the Buddhists call ananda. It is the motion of the serpent in space as it goes about unimpeded. It is also love, because it is moving simply to develop itself, to propagate itself in infinite space. But as soon as we put an obstacle in the way of this primary will, because the will is energy, it piles up against the obstacle and turbulates, and therefore it raises its temperature. This raising of the temperature of the will is what we experience psychologically as frustration. Now, if the obstacle is not very, very strong, the amount of turbulence generated before it breaks down is not very high. And if the obstacle is a very, very strong one, so that the amount of available willpower cannot break through it, it piles up against it and turbulates terribly and gets very, very overheated, and we then say this is experienced as hate. Now, the free movement of it as it's going along, unimpeded, we call love. But the impeded movement, when the will is impeded by a strong obstacle, we call hate. So that we say hate is love deprived of fulfillment in its action. Hate is love deprived of its object. When we come to consider that the absolute energy of sentient power has condensed itself into the material world, and therefore food itself is sentient power condensed, then we can see that when we eat food and break it down, we are releasing energies of similar qualities to the energies which precipitated themselves into that material form. It's from this you can see the meaning of rules about diet, that each form of food is actually an objectification of certain kinds of sentient power. That means each kind of food has a definite psychological correspondence. So if you eat one kind of food, you will feel happy. If you use another kind, you will feel miserable. Misgoverns all the early priestly laws about that. Each kind of material, being merely a condensed sentient power, a condensed psychological principle, necessarily acts back on the psyche when it is released, and therefore induces certain psychological states. All the drugs used in mental disorders these days are based on this fact, that they act on the sensorium in certain ways, simply by reversing the objectifying process of spirit, by returning the objectified spirit, or matter, or food, or drug, back into the original state it was before it was condensed. When the energy of the will is climbing up into a situation and succeeding easily in whatever it is doing, we say it is positive and it is saying yes to it. But if we were merely to say yes, then there would be a perpetual propagation of this power, and this power would never formulate itself, because it would never have a resistance to overcome. We imagine drawing a wiggly line to represent the propagation haphazardly of this power. This wiggling motion is the chaotic motion of the ancient philosophers. The motion in chaos is a non-ordered motion. Now, in its continuous wiggling about, occasionally it crosses over itself and it makes a rotating zone. Now, this rotating zone is an ordered zone, because the word order, and the root ord, is simply the same word, Sanskrit D to T, as the rota. There is no orderly system other than a recurrent system, a rotating system of force. And this rotating system spontaneously comes into existence through the prior chaotic motion of sentient power. And the so-called chaotic motion is simply a movement which has not got any mass inertia. And by mass inertia we mean that the energy has wound itself in, that's the in inertia, and is working, that's the out in inertia, and affirming that process. So if we say in, at, and ya, and then meaning Mr. Friedman, it says ya, at, in, affirm the work inside. This means that every material body, every material particle, is simply the affirmation by a spirit or sentient power or force of a zone in which it encloses itself and rotates and compresses itself. The mass inertia is simply the amount of energy working in that zone. The word energy is simply the same word here. En for IN, ER, G for T, and Y for affirmation, energy, is the same as in ATR. The affirmation of the work inside means energy. When we imagine this sentient power to come in from the chaos of free motion, in the act of rotating, it makes dome. It restrains itself in a sphere, and you observe that dome, Buxtehude, is mode. It is the way in which something is done. And the zone of dome is the zone of order, and beyond that is the zone of chaos. Orderly beings define chaos as undesirable. Chaotic beings define order as boredom. William Blake was well aware of this when he took sides with the chaotic and decided he would rather be a devil than have a 3 foot square lawn neatly to mow every evening in the sunshine. To him, the mode of doming was not a good thing, because it meant the imposition of restrictions on the free action of spirit. But to those inside the dome, it means security, it means protecting law, It means nobody can come and harm us, and it means we can predict everything. We can do what we like because we know what is going to happen. So the beings of the devil are those beings who have specialized in modes of control. And we find that the civilized world, I know Socrates can go by that. The civilized world is based upon modes of doing. And those people who have, in fact, affirmed the control have filled the earth with cities, that is, with control zones. And as the cities have grown progressively by ingesting the energies of chaos into them, and thus pushing out their boundaries like the expanding universe, so the interspaces between various domains have been reduced. So it is a very civilized people have made their cities grow and grow and grow. The amount of common lands and wastelands available for gypsies decreases. We see this in the case of the obvious dilemma of the nomadic peoples and the Arabs, and the growth of civilization and the modern state is really forcing the nomadic peoples to settle down, because either they settle down or they will have nowhere to settle at all very shortly. In the Bible, Jacob symbolizes Dome and Esau symbolizes chaos. The Hebrew for this won't dome is Edom. E means the field, and there is dome. Edom is outside the dome. He doesn't like it. Negate the dome. He wanders about chaotically. Esau was a hairy man, means that he was not bothering to shave. He was not a civilized person. Jacob was a smooth man. The cob in Jacob is the same as dome. It means lock the thing up and make a house of it. Yaakov means affirm the locking and closure of that house. But Edom means refuser. Now this Jacob is the fellow who supplants or takes away the heritage of Esau by a trick. He sets up a hierarchy of power when in fact he does not himself believe in it. He doesn't believe in the immediate application of power. He believes in the indirect method. So he puts on hairy gloves at his mother's request, and he receives the blessing of his father, and thus derives the benefits that should come to Esau to himself. We can see that the chaotic movement can be called impotent in one special sense, that if we translate the im as in, like we should, and the pot in potency as power, then the impotence is in power. Now, chaotic power can be seen within infinity, and is simply the power that is not rotating and ordering itself, that is, subjecting itself to recurrent behavior. Remember, order only means do it again and again and again and again till you establish expectancy. This expectancy, psychologically, is the same thing as inertia physically. If you get up at 7 in the morning and go off to work at 8 and come back at 5 and so on, if you do this every day, you will condition your organism until it deserves a medal for orderliness. And as the ladies were saying the other day in the news bulletin, now even the ladies have badges for orderliness, whereas perhaps 80 years ago they wouldn't have been given a badge at all. And now they've got a badge, they're very pleased. We can see here that the kind of potency in chaos, the impotence, the ens means essence, the essence of the power in the field infinite, that kind of power is no use to a being of order. A being of order is a being who wants to enclose, to rotate, to make a recurrent system so that it can establish a periodicity and a rhythm. Now we know that in religion and philosophy, the early thinkers were concerned with the rhythms of nature and specifically with the seasons of the year. In Egypt, it was possible to predict the flooding of the Nile simply because the Earth rotates and travels around the Sun, and certain weathers result from the recurrent motion of the Earth. And those people who learn these recurrent systems first are the dome or mode people. They're the people who saw how the universe works recurrently. And because they saw it and the others didn't, then they began to utilize it to gain power over their brothers who were not so preoccupied with recurrent orders. We can see two types of human being as basic to our four zodiacal divisions. And one type we could call the dome type, and the other type we could call the undome or free type. Now the Egyptian priests, studying the recurrence of phenomena in the Nile Valley, were able to predict, and they were able to subdue people who could not predict, and they fabricated a lot of religious mythological stories to obscure the fact that what they were really saying was based entirely on material rhythms in the earth. By obscuring the ground of their authority, they managed to persuade people that they had greater authority than they really possessed. And by their power of prediction, they were able to establish when to do certain things. Now we have more or less a four-season system of spring, summer, autumn and winter, and the agricultural cycle is based upon this. And those who know the agricultural cycle are basically the ones who are feeding the others. And because the agricultural cycle requires knowledge of astronomy, so the agriculturalists grew more and more conscious of the periodic nature of universal action. With the aid of this knowledge, they built the agricultural civilizations in the great river deltas and elsewhere, and with their knowledge they dictated to other beings who temperamentally didn't want to settle down in this agricultural recurrent manner. If we wrote inside the dome, agriculture, outside it we could write the hunters. Now the earth cultivators and the hunters are sort of two primary types of human beings that we see. The ones that settle down and dig in a certain place are tied by the earth that they dig, and the ones that do not dig run about chasing their food. They might be hunting radishes or truffles or deer, but they're on the move all the time instead of cultivating the ground. But the ones who are on the move develop a certain type of character and psychological response based on free action. But the ones that settle down develop another kind of culture based on bound action or restriction. Now there's a certain inherent dialectical relationship between these two. The one that is impotence itself, the infinite field, is the hunter. You see this hun in hunter, and the ter, which is the same as Torah law. This hun means the power that is running about. Those Hunnish peoples, the ancestors of the Huns that have been confused with the Germans, were people who believed that they ought to rush about the surface of the earth. And the others, who believed in doming, in agriculture and building of walls, settling down developed a totally different kind of world view. The ones who settled down developed a hierarchical view based on form, that is, on ritual, on social structure, on costume, on manners, and so on. Whereas the ones who ran about outside the dome had a hierarchy of immediate power. Now, each one can be considered to be impotent outside its own field. So if we take a city-bred dome man, a man that knows how to control himself and has very, very good manners, and we throw him into the middle of a vast plain where he's never been, and we put him on a wild Mongolian pony, he probably will not do very well because He doesn't know the laws governing outside, namely the laws of alertness, the laws of free motion of power. But in the same way, if we get one of the hunters and put him inside the town hall behind a desk, he would probably be a little confused and certainly feel very claustrophobic about staying there 8 hours a day. Now these are two different temperaments, and each one is potent in his own field, one in the finite field of the dome and the other in the infinite field of space. But when it is said that the whole world lies in the grip of the devil, it means that the whole material world is lying in the grip of the domers. Now you know in astronomy that the universe is said to be expanding. There's a kind of process of osmosis and endosmosis in the body where forces go through the membranes of cells, and they can go through both ways, osmosis and endosmosis. And in the same way, the forces from the infinite chaos can get through the rotating band of the macrocosmic sphere, and they can then proceed to blow this sphere out and make it bigger and bigger. Now, when John the Baptist sees Christ coming, he says of him, "He must increase and I must decrease." Any finite system is first of all a force that was in infinity and has rotated and bound itself up, but it has its origin in the infinite, so that the infinite is in pressing itself to rotate, and in so doing is making an orderly zone. But this orderly zone is an objectification of that which transcends order absolutely, namely the infinite. And in positing this orderly zone, it has negated its free state. So if we put a cross inside this circle to symbolize, like an electronic engineer would, the mark of the positive, what has been posited in the dome is a negation. That is a finiting process. Whereas if we go outside the dome and write the sign of the negative, what has been negated is the negation posited in the finite. Remember, we've had this before when we said, to create is to arc or rotate a force, and therefore to produce a finite, but a finite is a negative. Therefore to create is to posit a negation. Therefore if we rub out this posited negation, we are negating a negation, and two negations make a positive. And the positive absolute is that which is infinite, and therefore is not posited in the finite sense at all. Now, whatever is fed into the objective state of infinity is simply that which was infinite and has now become, through self-objectification, finite. And when it does so, it has fulfilled a purpose. Remember purpose, propositum, that which is placed before for realization. The object, the orb, thrown in infinity is simply a zone in which the powers of infinity have started to rotate. They have made a finite zone into which energy can be poured to a point of total fulfillment. This is the meaning of the word satisfaction. The sat in satisfaction means being. The fak in fakere, to make, to do. Satisfaction means that state in which one is full of being. But to be full of being is not simply to have a perimeter, it is to have the space within the perimeter full of force actualizing itself. And if we make a finite sphere and then insert force into it, then the force, by nature and the constraint of the sphere, rotates. And it is this rotating within the closure of the sphere
that we mean when we talk about order,
that is repetition of form. If we like to demonstrate it, we can get a bowl, and we can connect a tube to the water tap, and we can fill the bowl by simply squirting the water through the tube. And because the bowl is round, when the water leaves the tube and goes in the bowl, it goes round. And we see that that which would otherwise translate freely from the pipe, arriving in the constraint of the bowl, is forced to rotate. Now, in rotating in this way, it has gained order. But in gaining its order, it has lost its free initiative. Now, both this dome, which is impotent, that is to say, is a power standing in itself, and that transcendent infinite, which is also impotent, are exactly equal and opposite in one respect, namely that the concept of the boundary presupposed by finite existence limits the finite outwardly and limits infinity inwardly. So that towards every finite centre, we can say that infinity is restricted where the finite object exists. But we can also equally say that from the centre of the finite to its perimeter, the finite is limited by the infinite beyond itself. So that when we say to draw a circle, it's simultaneously to include and exclude. To include the finite and exclude the infinite, we are saying that these two, the infinite and the finite, are equally valid. They are concepts, and concepts have pairs, and you must assert a pair of opposites together or deny them together. So we see that this question of impotence is a very subtle one, because impotence might mean the power is held inside, or it might mean that there is no power held inside. Suppose when we get a balloon and we blow it up, and then we spray the surface of the balloon with a special plastic which penetrates the rubber and then sets very, very hard, and so that it's quite rigid, and then we draw all the air out and then seal it up. We now have a vacuum. Now, we can say that this one is impotent in the negative sense. It hasn't got any power on the inside. It cannot explode. It will implode if we increase the pressures on the outside of it. You can do this experiment by getting a metal can and an ordinary coffee tin will do with a good airtight lid. And you first of all heat it over the gas stove, and then you put the lid on it, and then you take it away and put it in a cold place. And while you're watching it, at a certain point the internal pressures of the can will be less than the external pressures of the air, and the can will implode. That is, it will suddenly collapse before your eyes, because the pressure of the relatively extracted air inside it has dropped lower than that outside. That's implosion. Now, that could represent the kind of impotence caused by lack of energy. Like the one we mentioned in the first place, the lack of willpower because you haven't eaten enough or rested enough. But there's another kind in which you stack the sphere with energy, and it's all there, but you reinforce the perimeter of the zone and make it so strong that although the inside is in very, very high tension indeed, yet you can't break out. Now, these two kinds of impotence, the impotence of death or lack, and the impotence of excessive restraint, are both equally valid. So we can find inside ourselves these, the one when we are tired or lacking in food, energy, and the other one where we can feel that we can do this job easily if only something would be removed that's stopping us. In psychological parlance, the thing that is stopping us would be called an inhibiting factor. Something is holding down this marvellous potential. I know a young artist who is going to paint like Michelangelo. To me that means that he doesn't know much about Michelangelo, because of course Michelangelo is not great as a painter at all.
is great as an artist, who is naturally a sculptor and who came into painting about the root, not really essential to himself. And when he paints, he simply paints sculptured forms. These forms are perfect, but they're not what we call painter's forms. They're sculptor's forms painted. He can feel that something is stuffing him. He doesn't know what it is, but something is. Now, it could be what the psychologist might call a complex, a negative complex of ideas that are telling him, do not do this thing that you are capable of, because if you do, you'll be worse off than if you don't. Happy low lie down, and easy lies ahead that wears the crown. If you make a success in a field, you might find yourself with a job for life, like the bungers up of rattles. And consequently, there may be a purpose in the kind of impotence that is experienced as an inner pressure with an inhibiting factor upon it. And we have to discover in ourselves just what is the meaning of the specific kind of impotence we experience. Is it simply that we ought to go to bed a bit earlier? Or ought to eat a bit more food? Or stop expending energy faster than we put it in? Or is it that we are stacked with energy and have certain inhibiting factors upon us, either psychological within ourselves, or external ones like social pressures that don't like the kind of talent that we want to exhibit? We have to find out for ourselves, in ourselves, whether we are suffering from the impotence of death or the impotence of external restrictions. And we have to find this out on three levels. On the level of will, we know basically what that is. It is a lack of energy from food or from lack of sleep. Impotence of feeling, when our feeling for and against are simultaneously presented so that they contradict each other in a simultaneous yes-no. And impotence of the ideas. Well, we may be simply lacking in ideas, or we may have ideas inside us which inhibit other ideas. We can say, because of our original law, the chemistry of all parts of space is the same, that all these types of impotence are simultaneously operating in the average person until he seriously works upon it. But at any given moment, the type of impotence being experienced will depend more on a lack of energy or on restricting influences than it will at another moment. Careful self-observation of behavior patterns and of feeling responses will tell us whether we are suffering from the impotence of lack or the impotence of external restrictions.
Jean, could I ask something about the terms of my own satisfaction? Could you check on the double meaning, two letters together, like the two L's in gull, the interchangeability of T and G in ert and erg, and why it even negates the dome in Edom?
Well, if you remember that each letter has a symbolic value, at once upon a time these letters were drawings of things, of plants, of animals, parts of man, utensils of all kinds. And they were chosen because they symbolize a kind of function. And they have descended to us in a very simplified form, and yet they have retained, through the sheer inertia of usage, a large percentage of their original meaning. So that if we take, say, the letter N, in the Egyptian, which is simply the waving of water, the ripples on water. And we cut this down for economy's sake, and we just draw an up and down, we get the letter N. Now, what they were talking about was the motion of the water. Now you can see that when you pronounce a letter N, if you feel what you're doing with your tongue against the palate, and the way you press it, you will see that the palate and the tongue are making this form, that the organs of speech are unconsciously mimicking the behavior of the natural function. Now, if we close the lips on this thing, as if we were to draw a circle and then fill it with these things, the circle says, this is bound. The motion inside it says it is still going on. And if we make this sound with the lips closed, it makes the letter M. Now, this letter M is simply motion enclosed, so that we can use M as a symbol of mass, meaning mass, energy, mass, motion, simply a zone in which motion has compacted itself. When we set off the letter A, the Aleph of the Hebrew, the letter itself is made in a form rather like the letter N, only slightly more indicative. And it merely has three parts, which we've treated of before. And in the Greek, it's another shape, looking like a Taurus sign in the zodiac, only turned on its sign. And all of these equal the absolute. And the next letter of the alphabet is a B, which means the zone of bondage, the dome. So that when we are wishing to represent the concept of dome, we simply draw a circle. And the earliest form of the letter B is a circle. Another form with a squared pen is a square, and sometimes with a line through it, makes a two-roomed house plan, and then you might write it cursively as we do. But all the letters on the later side of the letter B symbolize finite processes and objects, whilst the one letter prior to the B, the A, symbolizes the absolute. You remember that we said that when all the letters of the alphabet mythically present themselves to God and say, please create with us, each one shouts for himself, but God begins with the letter B. Because B means boundary, it means the B in the beginning. And he can't start with A, because A is absolute and eternal. And the eternal is not a start at all. In the word start, you can see the taro. The taro, which is the anagram of the rotor again. The word tart, which means sharp, is a reference to the planet Saturn pressing on a point, sharpening itself up. So this starting process is a finiting process, and prior to the start is the eternal absolute. When we come to the next vowel in the Hebrew, the letter is E. And this E symbolizes a hole, an air hole. In the Hebrew, it is written as if it were a tent with a back and a roof and a little bit of cloth in front to stop the sand blowing on your feet while you're sitting inside. And there's a ventilation hole for your exhalations of alcohol to go out. Now, this letter is called He, it is our letter E, and it symbolizes the universal field as opposed to the infinite absolute. For the infinite absolute, we can draw nothing. But for the universal field, we can draw a circle and put nothing in it. Put nothing in it at all, it's just a circle, or a zone in which spirit is going about. But we don't want to draw it. Now we said that the Aleph level is the level of the absolute, and that is the Godhead, the source of all divinity. But the universal level is the mark of the high priest, of the pontiff, who claims to know about this absolute, but he himself, the pontiff, is actually visible in the finite world. He's got a boundary. He's saying, I know that beyond this boundary you should not go. And I am the owner of the boundary. I am the voice of the boundary. And I am telling you that the absolute has set up this boundary in order that you don't get lost. And in order that you don't get lost, you will pay me to remind you not to go beyond the boundary. This is the priestly function of limiting the limitable. This Letter E, therefore, represents the field of universal, not of absolute, the field of universal energies, and is under the dominion of the high priest. Now, the next letter related to it is a letter called Het, which is our letter H. It's nearly the same as the letter He, except there is no air hole, it is blocked. And it is said to mean a hedge. And in this phase, the thing appears as a ladder, usually with three rungs on it. We've cut the top and bottom off and use only one rung. And this ladder, or hedge, had a variety of uses, like the run pole or perch did. You could take this hurdle, and you could put several of these together and pen the sheep into it. Or you could use them as a ladder to climb up somewhere. You could do a remarkable lot of things with a few ladders for penning animals in. And therefore this letter H, the aspirant letter as we call it, is the letter symbolizing all ambition, or hierarchical forces, under the dominion not of the universal, but of the developed individual, whom we call the hetman, or headsman, the man who knows how to give orders from the individual level without an appeal to the universal or the absolute. He considers himself sufficiently well developed as an individual to order about any beings at levels lower than he is. He can't order the universal about because the universal knows the trick. He can't order the absolute about because the absolute has no order whatever. It transcends order completely. But he can order about beings below him. We represent by the letter K. Well, the letter K symbolizes the cupped hand drawn like this. And if you imagine we draw a hand very simply like this, and there's your wrist and there's your little finger. This is a cupped hand, and then you turn it on its side like this, and that's a letter cup or K, and it symbolizes the idea of control or containing something, like a cup, same word as cup, cuff. And it means the intellectual, the man who is a good clerk, the clergyman, the man who can write, and he receives his orders from the headman. And he himself has no individual power other than that vested in him by the act of writing. The scribes and the monks who were writing out, copying documents, gradually became the bookkeepers of the world because they could write. They had an intellectual superiority to beings below them, but they have no authority whatever over the headman, or the iman, or the amen. Their authority is always over beings below them. Now, the only being below an intellectual is a man that spends all his time, as we say, talking through the back of his head. The Hebrew letter is a drawing of the back of a man's head. There's the back of his scalp, there's his spinal column. I'll draw the whole man in. Looks a bit jumbly. And this letter is the letter Q. You can see it in some form, to our Q, like that, turned round. And it simply means sexuality. A much more obvious symbol of it is when you draw a circle and put a straight line. The circle symbolizes female, straight line, male. The circle symbolizes anything whatever that is defined and has a boundary. The straight line symbolizes any force that can break either in or out of that boundary without permission. So the circle is passive relative to the straight line. Now, below the level of the intellectual, the clerk, the fellow who can write, the scribe, is simply the Q man, or sexually directed man, the man whose whole joy in life is a whole joy in life. And he has only this one function, only this one interest. He wants to go and get himself into a sexual relation, and because of certain inhibiting factors imposed upon him by K-men and Het-men and E-men, he usually needs alcohol to help him. Alcohol, of course, comes from the absolute. The Al in alcohol means God, and the Ko means to relate to the holy, back again into chaos. Alcohol has the funny effect of discoordinating the already established inhibitions of the social code, and therefore it's a very good substance for ingesting for cumin. But the cumin is the lowest kind of man, in the sense that in the social hierarchy he is under everybody else's orders. He's under the orders of the clerk because he has to go and get a card and stamped, and he's under the orders of people who transport him backwards and forwards. He's under the orders of his brewer and his cigarette manufacturer and so on. Then the clerk, the scribe, is under the orders of the headman. The headman acknowledges that the universal exists, that the priest exists, but he has a very, very simple reply to the universalist, and that is that the universal can act only through the particular, and that it acts through the best particular best. And the headman claims to be this best particular, and therefore, whatever the priest said about universal truth, he says, yes, I agree with you, you are talking about myself. The universalist, however, cannot appeal to anything other than pure logic to establish his case of universality, because if he goes beyond the pure logic of the rationale of religion, he goes into the absolute, beyond the definition. And as soon as he goes beyond the definition of the universal, he has unfortunately inverted the whole process. Because the same absolute energy is the same energy that feeds in the cumin at his sexual level. So as soon as the universalist, the high priest, tries to go beyond the definitions that establish his right to rule in this priestly manner and goes into the absolute, he's gone from the field of relative function to the field of absolute power. And the absolute power can and does function at any level whatever immediately, and therefore he undoes himself. So that wherever the high priest, wherever the church, has tried to establish its case with pure logic, it has had to stop at a certain level, as we see in the Summa of Thomas Aquinas. Simply because if it goes beyond this ultimate reason, it turns from a rationale of the universe into the will of the absolute behind it. And at this point, it transcends the need for its own existence, because, as William Blake said, the lust of the goat is the bounty of God. And the orders may well go the other way. That is to say that the people who are cued might, in fact, rise up against the clerks, and they might drive the clerks into unions. You know that the Q people are concerned with unions, and drive the clerks to make unions against headmen, and headmen have already made their personal union against universal men, and all these universal men are then driven into ecumenical councils to try to stop the absolute from feeding the Q men with the data that overthrow the system. So that when we're considering the question of potence and impotence, we should in fact remember to view it both from inside and outside the limiting dome.